Hello and welcome to the Undercut Podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Jesse Billington, and we're back to review the fifth race of the Formula One 2024 season, the Chinese Grand Prix. Yes, it is back, and well, it wasn't half bad, I don't think. And to review it, I'm joined by Timo Albus Daly and Ellie Mae Taylor. How are you all?
I enjoyed the World Endurance Championship this weekend, so we had some good racing.
Yeah. What was Ferrari?
Well, we know where the F1 strategists went, to be fair.
Yeah, China. They sort of fumbled that one. It wasn't too bad if you're watching the IndyCar, and NASCAR was pretty close once again.
Yeah, that was kind of entertaining. I didn't dislike the Chinese Grand Prix, but it's ranked fourth out of the five for me so far this year. I've enjoyed three others better so far, I think, which is slim pickings between it and Japan, I admit, because they're pretty much even keel, but the only one that was definitely worse for me was Bahrain. But it's a shame because I really like being back in China. But as we'll get into, it just felt like a whole weekend packed full of potential and not a lot of it really came through. But we'll get into that. Ellie Mae, how are you?
Apart from my heartburn, I'm good, thank you. I think it's karma. I've got some Rennie.
I've got Gaviscon to hand if you want some. Not that it'll be much good because we're on a Zoom call.
But anyway. I think it's karma for the fact that I went shopping on the weekend. And instead of getting a McDonald's, I opted for a salad.
Ooh, that is too much fibre in your diet.
And ever since I've had heartburn.
Should have gone for a crispy chicken item. Anyway, I was a private project on Saturday and missed a scramble on the Sunday, and it was very nice to see lots of very interesting and cool cars there. So yeah, fantastic times for all of us. And of course, the Chinese Grand Prix, which was also a sprint weekend, which we sort of glossed over a bit in the run-up to it. We sort of anticipated that maybe one practice session would be enough to leave teams and drivers plenty befuddled before it all kicked off, but it seemed that it was very much the same old, same old. But we'll get to that in due course, because there's some interesting news from, in reality, most of our news comes from a bunch of other series, and we'll kick off with the Iron Dames.
Yeah, it was a nice little story that came out last week, naturally pretty much probably just after we'd finished recording our Chinese Grand Prix preview, as is always the case. Marta Garcia started things off by announcing that she joined Iron Dames, but we weren't really sure what that meant just yet. And then a little bit later on in the week, probably the same day, it just seemed very long, Dorian Pin announced that she would be her teammate in the Formula Regional Bi-Alpine Championship for this year, and they showed off their liveries, which are quite decent looking, I've got to say. And it's the first dedicated Iron Dame entry into a single-seated championship. And that championship's got 10 rounds over the course of this year, which is all in Europe. And that's quite interesting. But for me, it does kind of ask the question of Garcia joining this championship was meant to be seen as a step up from F1 Academy. But now Pin's doing both at the same time. So is it a good thing? Is it frustrating? Because it's kind of maybe both frustrating and a good thing, or is it neither? Because it feels like Pin's got the award for winning F1 Academy before she's even won F1 Academy. So do they find someone else to put in for the teammate to make it more fair, or is it a good sign that a young driver is getting a seat in this championship? But then does that leave a bit of taste in Marta Garcia's mouth and keep driving of her rage? I don't mind it, but it's frustrating for me because I still think she should have gone into Formula 3, for example.
I think you've got to bear in mind that Dorian Penn's been part of the Iron Dames sort of setup for quite some time. So it's sort of only reasonable that when they went, you know what, let's start up a sort of Formula Regional campaign, and they went, who have we got that does single-seater racing? And they went, oh yeah, Dorian Pin. So they sort of went, you there, tiny French girl, get in the single-seater. And I mean, it's more track time in single-seaters, which is something she sort of really relishes while she's battling out the championships. It's great
experience. I'd just be curious if she then wins F1 Academy.
What do they do then? Yeah, I suppose at that point they can't then simply give her another seat in Frecca.
Here's your reward, this thing you've already done.
Yeah. Oh, you've already completed that one. I suppose at that point, she could sort of turn it down. That seat goes to second or third place, and she goes into F3.
It's already been going to second or third place, though. They've got the option.
Yeah. So, I don't know. It just opens up the opportunity. It means that sort of back seat is there. I don't know. That's for F1 Academy to decide what to do with the fact that they've got talent in their pool that's already out-accelerating itself.
That's kind of what I want to sort of touch upon. I think because everything is so new and there seems to be no easy sort of progressional ladder for female drivers in racing, I think we're perhaps going to see a lot of this until the pathway is a lot more clear cut or women are seen to be equal and on the same level as men. I think we're currently obviously in the midst of seeing what that pathway is, and it may be that unfortunately in some sense the earlier female careers are hindered in this journey as they sort of set out the pathway for the women coming up behind them. I think at the moment, whilst we don't want this, I think that success is perhaps going to be more about creating a clear-cut pathway for women rather than seeing the results on track as such.
That's what frustrates me most, I think, is that generation of drivers, the kind of, she's kind of the same generation-ish as Jamie Chadwick, but those kind of drivers having to weirdly, whilst they're being the ones forging the path, they're also having to fight for scraps in some respects as well, which is very frustrating given how long and hard they've worked to get where they are, for them to just have the next person come along and get exactly what they had to fight a whole year for. Like, oh yeah, here you go, just go for it immediately. It's not a bad thing, but it's still annoying.
There's a strange element of sacrifice to it that you'd sort of rather than not be, because you're sort of sacrificing some fantastic talent. You mentioned Jamie Chadwick.
And it doesn't feel like you're sacrificing your pawn for the sake of the knight. It feels like you're sacrificing a bishop for the sake of the knight. I'm not sure if that's a good enough trade-off. Mm.
And you look at the talent of Chadwick, you look at Garcia, you look at Power, what they're achieving and what they're able to produce on track. You're sort of going, yeah, they're sort of just being sort of worn out as the snowplow sort of cutting through all the sort of trials and paperwork and testing. It'd be great to see something a bit more sort of proactive come of this. And I think Marta Garcia has possibly got a chance of doing that, but certainly Dorian has, by doing these two series at once and proving that in reality the leftward step into another F4 series is not what F1 Academy needs to be doing. It needs to be doing that step forwards up the chain.
Well, I quite liked what the El Kobasi sisters were doing, because they were in UAE F4 or whichever one it was recently. Kind of, they're doing that in between rounds and doing all that kind of thing. Like, that's what I'm more on board with, whereas it's still just slightly under Frecker from my understanding of the
Frecker is hierarchy F4 as well.
Of it.
But
it feels like in terms of status, it's
in status, I think, because it sort of often acts as a feed, a support series. To
like if you got offered for an F1 Academy to go into F4 UAE, you wouldn't be thinking that's a step up. Whereas if you go into Frecker, it's kind of, oh, okay, I understand that you're still for F3, but you can see that. Whereas this kind of just move around in your sideways circles. Who is it? Is it just Edgar who's doing two seasons at the same time, like British? Abby Pulling's doing British
GB4, GB3 or something.
GB4 was doing that seems to fit nicely as a complementary thing. So it's kind of stay in the realm, but then I just want it more established.
Yeah, I think a sort of greater classification and clarification of sort of the strata of single-seater racing by the FIA would really help define what's going on. And equally, I think when that does happen, if they do sort of clearly delineate Frecker as being a bit of a step above F1 Academy, but not quite F3, then all of a sudden we're going to see sort of F1 Academy have to buck its ideas up if you've got drivers that are doing F1 Academy and, with all hope and reason, touch wood, doing well in Frecker too. And I think we will see Pan doing pretty competitively in Frecker. Again, give her a few rounds to get her feet under the table. But I think once she's there and running, there's going to be a lot to be very quickly proven, I think. So it'll be interesting to see how that one pans out. Speaking of, we'll transfer from talking about one female driver to another, and Juju Noda, because of course we've seen Super Formula kick off, and Teo Pourchaire isn't out in the Far East this weekend. He is instead in the Far West in Long Beach, California, for the IndyCar. That was a really strange link. But yeah, Teo Pourchaire has been plucked from his Super Formula seat to go and do IndyCar for the weekend just gone at the Long Beach Grand Prix. and didn't do too badly. Stepped in for Aaron McLaren driver David Malukas, who's still recovering from an injury. Callum Ilott had been filling in, but he's only not there because he's back in his full-time season at WEC for the 6 hours of Imola, which we've sort of already mentioned. And there's been no word of this being like a performance-based reason. It was simply a case of he was needed in Italy for Hertz Team Jota in the Porsche 963. So sort of Aaron McLaren went, who else do we know that's sort of a very talented F2 driver that was sort of overlooked by F1? Oh yes, you there, Teo Pourchaire. Come here, boy. Put this orange race suit on and drive around.
Quite interesting for him. I mean, watching the race last night, didn't qualify too badly. I kind of wanted him to do what Iwasa did in free practice in Japan, of just keep your head down. This is a circuit and a race that there's always drama of some kind there. You just want to avoid whatever happens and just come out cleanly. He finished P11 ahead of some significantly other big names in IndyCar, and for a debut, that's not too bad at all. And it wasn't that I disliked him in Formula 2 at all, but he said this next bit could be misconstrued as that, but he came across in the interviews, and his approach of the weekend whenever you saw him outside the car was just very approachable, much more likable in some sense. He seemed like he'd finally, maybe he had maturity on the inside, but it wasn't necessarily feel like it on the outside, and it felt like he'd grown into that maturity level, if that makes sense. And he just seemed to be very happy with the opportunity, not being too stressed out about it, going, yeah, this is IndyCar, it's pretty cool, I'm going to make a debut at Long Beach. He's got points on the board now. Well, obviously he would do this IndyCar, but you know, it's always reassuring to get some more points. And yeah, he was McLaren's only hope for parts of that race, which was quite ridiculous, because the commentary say, like, you're the leading McLaren now, like, don't tell him that. Yeah, he will, that he might shit the bed.
But yeah, sort of personality and approach-wise, he seemed to sort of really ease and mature into this, I think, certainly sort of bobbing off and doing Super Formula and sort of looking for other opportunities and looking at what other drivers have made of IndyCar as well. It's becoming a bit of a driver's series. It's people who go and do it and enjoy getting to race in IndyCar because it is you can properly sort of tangle with it and get to grips and properly race. And yeah, he didn't do too badly, I think. Kudos for the guy stepping in first time round. They are tough old beasts to try and haul around, especially a tight street circuit with that.
Grosjean had an unusual race where he didn't Grosjean, and if he had done that, he'd have been inside the top 10, which seems ridiculous for an IndyCar debut with how competitive that series is.
And especially when you consider he's up against Scott Dixon, who was winning Grand Prix in IndyCar before Teo Pourchaire was born, or was he in Indy Lights that time? So, like, he's up.
No, they were saying about Colton Herta and him battling for the lead, just like when Scott Dixon was in Indy Lights, Colton Herta was just being born. So it's that kind of ilk, and then Pourchaire is even younger than him.
So it's a ridiculous thing that he's being thrust against these properly fantastic drivers that everyone just glosses over because they're in IndyCar, and sort of going, well, he's sort of holding a candle to him. So it's not a bad performance there from Teo.
It kind of made me laugh that in the commentary and qualifying, how they were like, it's amazing how he's not sort of seconds behind the slowest driver here. And it's kind of like, what bar is there for people coming in if they're sort of seconds?
They seem to have not learned on that one, to be fair, because they've had a couple of Indy Next drivers from last season come in this season and do better than we thought they might do, but in terms of like even when they've been a little further up, they've not been miles up, like you say. So they just keep trying this line, I think, and hoping that they're going to be, like, third time lucky, we're going to be right by saying this driver should be miles off and a damn Pourchaire. We didn't think this through.
It's also very much the American style of broadcast, by sort of that way you've got something really nice to say about someone on the broadcast. You can be chipper and upbeat and American on NBC Sports, and you can sort of go, look at him, he's doing fantastic, he's so close to the rest of the field. And that's, you can sort of...
Or by really contrast, if you want to have something really simple to be happy about, you can be the NASCAR commentators from yesterday getting fascinated by the word hullabaloo.
That is a great phrase, and I imagine in a NASCAR commentator's voice, like proper sort of...
Go and watch the highlights. It's near the start. It is hilarious because they've got two guys unsure of what the word is, and then the third guy, who's clearly the lead and older commentator, making some comment about the race, and they go, oh, and it's pronounced hullabaloo. Just kind of this disappointed manner.
Same as the TikToker this week that discovered the drinks brand Schweppes and thought it was which I hope they did that on purpose for the likes. Anyway, moving on from Shaw PPs to podium finishers and Pininfarina, where we had the wreath is back in Formula One, the winner's wreath, which is quite nice. It's sort of a one-off for the Chinese Grand Prix, a Pininfarina design sort of wreath trophy that was described as being wearable, which I think is daft because any trophy is wearable if you operate it wrong enough. But yeah, this one was really nice.
Especially if Lando's anywhere near it.
Especially if Lando's anywhere near it. But like a standard trophy, you can just put that on your head and you've got a hat, man. That's wearable. But anyway, the design incorporates elements of dragons, as it is, of course, Year of the Dragon in China. So it was quite a nice looking trophy and a different looking one to have in the trophy cabinets at Woking and Milton Keynes.
I really liked it, but I did also think it is quite a wide trophy, which Red Bull are struggling to have all their trophies in their trophy cabinet, so I thought that's going to take up a lot of room.
I like the idea that they're all designing trophies to be as awkwardly shaped now just to piss off Red Bull.
You're like, where are you going to fit this one, boys? And like, like play like sort of hoopla with it? I don't know. Like find the smallest F3 driver and give them to him as a hula hoop. I don't know. They must be running out of ideas soon. But it's not the only news that's coming out of F1. And this was something that sort of trickled out towards the end of the race weekend. There's possibly a new point system that's being postured by the principals.
Well, F1 itself and then team principals are having the conversation about it. So apparently they're having a virtual meeting here at Miami to talk about extending the points paying positions down to E12. Which, when I heard that, I just collective groan of why, and just makes me want to revert back to even harsher times where you only got points down to sixth and you've got to properly work for it. It's, I mean, I'll see what you two think, but I'm just not a fan of it. It just seems like another desperate attempt by Liberty and F1 to go, oh, look how competitive our sport is because we've now got more teams getting more points and more drivers getting more points and just trying to shove the attention away from the fact that the cars are nowhere near as competitive as they promised them to be, and that we're not in one of the most dominant periods of F1 history, even by F1 standards. So, I mean,
how many teams that is on 0 points? Is it three or four?
At least three.
Three. Alpine, Sauber, and Williams.
Williams.
What about Drogon? You got points in Bahrain, didn't you?
Yeah. It just for me, it feels like the drivers that were always fighting for P10, they're not going to bother fighting for that as much now because they'll just be content with P11 or P12 and all of this sort of thing. And then it just, I don't know, just doesn't sit right. For like IndyCar, fair enough, they've always been doing that. It's for as far as I can remember. And or you come into the freshness, just how it's done. They don't really tweak their point system all that much from what I've gathered. Whereas F1, it just feels like, right, we're going to do, like, since 2000, it's been tweaked a good handful of times. And it just feels like we stop meddling with the formula. The formula is good as it was, and it was better before in some ways. I mean, you always go back to that interview with that Mark Webber did where he's saying Perry finished inside the top 10 in his first Grand Prix, I think, in Australia. Didn't get points for it, but then when he did get his first point on the board, it felt that extra bit satisfying because you know you'd worked for it and it really felt like you'd achieved something. And this would then cheapen that because, well, P12 is good enough, I suppose. And you look at that P12, like, you're happy with that?
Yeah, points is an exclusive club on the grid that you have to be in F1, the top half.
You've got to prove that you get this. Isn't just, yeah. Again, if we're going to go for the romanticizing of it's the pinnacle of motorsport, well, then you fight for every damn point you can get. I mean, how happy was Hülkenberg at the weekend by getting a single point again? Incredibly. So
yeah, you start devaluing the concept of it further down. You want it to be an exclusive club that you've got to really work to get into, show you're in the top half of performers in your field. And yeah, I think it's an interesting one. I like the idea of sort of broadening out the span of the inter-team battles, especially when it comes to constructors scrabbling around at the bottom for those points. It will get really heated. I think there's still going to be a drive for fighting for 12th and 11th. But yeah, I think the overall thing is just make the cars better. But you look at sort of the general finishing positions, at the moment, everything pretty much shakes down to, with the exception of Australia, you sort of get the two Red Bulls at the front, you get the Ferraris behind, and then you get the McLarens, and then you get either Aston Martin or Mercedes, and that pretty much locks out your top 10. And there's
what incentive is there for everyone else if you're to try things and be more daring with your plans if you're going to give points to further down the grid? If you wouldn't get an Albon Australia 2022 situation, for example, then where like we're going to go all out and we're going to do one stop on the last lap to get 1 point because that means so much to us. I'm like, sod it, P12, that'll do. We can get that easy.
Yeah, but if you're the driver that's going to be fighting for P12, that point is still going to mean something to you.
Yeah, but it's going to be more if it's P10.
It's going to be more of it.
It only goes as far as P10.
But also, you're still going to be fighting for P11, P12. And if you're in P13, you're going to be fighting for P12.
Just
the battles are still going to exist. I think it's not the fact that it's not that it disincentivizes it. It's the fact that it cheapens the fact that points are only awarded to half the grid. If you're a point scorer, you're within the top half of your field in that race.
And so if you're going to awkward, you might as well do the whole grid, and you might as well go the full hog with IndyCar, and then go, well, you get a point for pole, you get a point for if you lead a lap, you get a point if you do a pit stop in under 5 seconds, the stake will never get one for that, and all this kind of stuff, and just go for it that way. Or would you just leave it well alone and just learn that that's not the problem with your sport at the moment, it's the fact that you promised closer racing, and by closer you actually meant just closer, but not actually if you want to get first.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I think it'll be interesting to see what the team principals have to say, because they will have sat down and really...
Well, we know what they're going to say. The top five will say no, thank you, and the bottom five will say yes, please.
Yeah, ultimately. I think James Vowles is going to be like, yes, please, give me points for 11th and 12th, because that's pretty much where Albon's finishing on the dot every weekend this year. But with points out of the way, it's time to peer into the preamble and a quick bit of practice, where Lance Stroll came top in the practice session, which... it was a bit of an odd one, but everyone else was sort of on a very strange tyre strategy for that one. I think he just bolted on softs at the end, laid down an absolute sort of godlike lap against everyone on a slight softer compound and sort of topped it. I didn't get a chance to watch that. It was 4 a.m. So really,
so by contrast, just to put him into context, as for P5 and P6, Ocon was P8 and Albon was P9. So, and there were also a couple of pigs flying around in the background. So it was a bit of an odd one.
Bit of an odd one there. And then we get to the sprint shooter.
And fire,
yeah. Because the cars...
we don't really know what caused that yet.
It was cars sparking. The They're going over the bump.
Well, you say that, but they're sparking that much on wet grass that it makes it go off like that?
Yeah, because you're getting these shavings.
That didn't convince everyone.
It's not a lightweight spark. You're getting these shavings of sort of titanium spitting out. They're quite hot.
Just anyway. The dragon.
Yeah, the dragon as well. And just something. It's like the inverse to Bernie Eccleston's sprinkler system to try and make F1 more exciting.
Set everything. It's doing Clarkson. Let's just set everything on fire and make it look cooler.
Yes.
Just while we're on that, before you just move on quickly, I just wanted to say that that set of corners just before the back straight, it looks like there's grandstands there, but there aren't. But I think that's just such a missed opportunity there, because that'd be a great little spot to watch the racing. And I just kept seeing the wording or whatever the hell that is there. I thought, why is there no one there? That'd be a great little spot. There's some fun little moves over the course of both races to where there was something there. It's a shame. You'd sell that out in no time.
You're sort of going to a tight left there, then it's a big sweeping right that goes out onto the long straight, isn't it? And
you can probably see, if you're at the right angle, some of the straight it beats, and you stick a nice TV there and you can have a little bit of a gander.
Yeah, the setup for the Shanghai circuit, it's nowhere near Shanghai. It's always been a bit of a sort of miss with teams and production personnel. I know that a lot of the radio and TV crews have never really liked going there. I haven't really heard back on what it was like this year, but it's also such an enormous site. It's so vast and spread out that it takes ages to really sort of get around and get anywhere. I mean, if you're watching Ted's Notebook afterwards, you'd have seen Adam Norris, Lando's dad, cutting about on one of the McLaren's little e-scooters just to try and sort of get anywhere in a reasonable time. It's a strange location, the Shanghai circuit, but it produced some all right racing in the day, and I just don't think the ground effect cars that we've got at the moment are the right cars for that circuit, even if it is sort of brilliantly wide, so you can put cars next to each other.
Those circuits.
Anyway, Norris top sprint shootout in the rain, beating Hamilton after his lap time was reinstated. Are we all clear on why his lap time was reinstated?
Yes.
The words were all Chris probably asleep and not paying attention.
It was essentially, if you...
Is that the short version?
No. If you overstep the mark through the final corner, and thus sort of with the knowledge of sort of throwing away a lap time that you're on to try and straight line and get a better launch into the next lap, the FIA then take away your next lap because you're deemed to have gained an advantage before starting. You've got a higher speed as you enter it. You've got a better chance through the first straight. But then they sort of look back. Which makes sense, but then they looked at Norris's back and went, yeah, but he's skittering across the gravel in the wet. There's no way he's going to go faster. And sure enough, the lap they deleted wasn't actually any faster than the lap they deleted that he'd sort of gone off on. So they said, look, you can have that one back. Clearly, you didn't actually improve your time going through there. So you didn't gain an unfair advantage by going off track. So you can keep your time. And it was interesting to see the sort of swings and roundabouts of the McLaren's pace across the weekend.
Yeah, I think for me, the only real note I had on the sprint qualifying was, as interesting as it was and the rain causing a bit of chaos at the end, I found it really hard to get excited for it because it was just for the sprint. And I thought, if this was actual qualifying for the race, ooh, we're in for something interesting here. I mean, you've got, like you say, you've got that top three of Norris, Hamilton, Alonso. You've got Joe in P10 at his home race, Russell just behind him in 11. You've got Leclerc going into the barriers a little bit. You've got Max out of position. Yeah, he'd probably win. That's no problem. But again, you've got the prospect of it for a Grand Prix. And you had the very nice symmetry of all the blue cars pretty much going out in the first qualifying session of the sprint. But it just kind of, it was like, I can't get on board with the excitement levels that the commentators clearly had for him. Well, Alex Chase at the very least, but he's always very excitable because he loves everything, and fair play to him. But it just felt like, it's a shame this isn't for qualifying, and I just don't care.
Yeah, I agree that it was a shame that it wasn't for qualifying, because it was obviously, it wasn't for that qualifying wasn't for the race, because it was, it would have ended up probably being a bit of a spicier race, maybe not with the Red Bulls.
We're saying there's that potential there, though.
But you know, you would have probably had that battle of like Norris and Hamilton and Fernando Alonso coming in, and we didn't really get that in the race.
No, the sprint didn't really shake down to produce the excitement we were anticipating there. Norris bottled it really off the start, and Hamilton had a pretty ace getaway from the line.
I wouldn't say Norris bottled it as such. I mean, he didn't get a great start off the line, no, but we saw then in the race with Perez and Alonso that there was enough space for two cars to get around turn one. I think the issue was that Hamilton just had terrible understeer and it didn't leave Norris a lot of room. So I don't think it was a case of it all being Norris's doing.
It's not necessarily Norris's doing.
I disagree. I'd say that understeer
as well.
I'd say he lost it straight at the start. You saw that if you compare his start in the sprint to Max's on Sunday in the Grand Prix, how aggressively Verstappen covered off P2 straight off the line in the Grand Prix. If Norris had done that, he gave Lewis far too much room immediately. He moved a little bit, but nowhere enough. And you don't need to invite Hamilton for more than the smallest of the gaps for him to try and exploit that. And he's going to do what he's going to do, especially when he's gone this long without a win of any kind. He's going to do it. So I think if Norris had been more aggressive there, he could have at least kept it for a bit longer. He'd have still lost the sprint because Verstappen had done his thing, but he could have stayed ahead there. But for me, that was just another case of him not covering off Hamilton, and he should probably know better by now.
But then Hamilton got a much better start off the line than Norris. It was a case of that.
Yeah, Norris, but if Norris had been able to cover him off, then Hamilton would have been forced to the outside, maybe, and Norris had been able to control it. Maybe he still would have lost it, but it didn't feel like he tried enough to cover or to stop Hamilton from launching forward as much.
I think the problem he had was he sent it round the outside. He had a big weight on the start line for the rest of the grid to form behind him, so he lost a lot of tyre temperature, and then immediately launching it round the outside through turn one didn't have the sort of mechanical grip from the tyres to hold it in a car that had been struggling and was still awaiting further setup tweaks to deal with oversteer. It just had too loose a back end, so he couldn't even try and put power down to try and sort of race him around the outside. It was sort of a dud hand Norris sort of dealt himself. So it was, yeah, it was an interesting start. A great racing from the Ferraris, going properly sort of toe-to-toe. Hamilton, a lot of racy driving, but then didn't sort of get the run together for qualifying later. An interesting sort of fall-off in pace from Hamilton across the day. Verstappen having to shrug off Sainz and get through the field suggests we really should have reverse grids for these, though, because there was a bit of a fight from Max coming through and actually having to work for it. And it's, you know, he's coming through, but it's fun to watch him have to race, though. And the other drivers, certainly Sainz, Norris, do give him a bit of a hard time as he's coming through. They do try and race him, Sainz especially, because he knows he's putting together a CV this year and people are going to watch it back and go, oh yeah, you made Verstappen work for that one. That's what we want to see. Unless, of course, you're looking for a second.
The only memorable thing from the sprint was that battle towards the end between Alonso, Sainz, Leclerc and Perez with Perez's move on Alonso and Sainz being very reminiscent of Hamilton in Silverstone 2022. It was just like, wait a minute, I've seen this before.
Yeah, a really good twofer. But
Verstappen as well, having a 12-second lead after about 10-ish laps of being in the lead towards Earth is ridiculous.
It is a little bit absurd. However, the sprint was the first time I really noticed this and got thinking about it. ideal commentary team is Nico Rosberg and Harry Benjamin. Maybe I've still got Harry sort of stuck as a bit of an eel in my brain after Goodwood, but I like Harry's style of commentating and saying what's happening, and I love Nico's ability to sort of pick apart, praise, chastise, explain the technical side of what's going on. And it's really good, and equally he's become genuinely sort of unbiased as well in his approach. He's gone back to singing the praises of Hamilton a little bit, which is quite nice after their sort of rivalry. But equally, when it comes to the other drivers, he's just a sort of balanced and sort of gives a little bit and takes a little bit, and he's captivated by the racecraft, and you can tell that he enjoys it as well deeply.
I'm glad you brought this up, because I was also going to mention how much I enjoyed Nico's commentary. He gives such an in-depth analysis of why something is happening, but he explains it in a way that's clear and in an easy manner that most people can follow. And we don't normally get that. And I think part of that is because, I mean, I love Martin Brundle. I love the way that he commentates as well. But Nico Rosberg has been racing only what?
More recently.
Yeah, recently.
6 years ago, eight years ago.
Yeah, so he knows. I mean, they are sort of obviously much different cars now, but he still has that knowledge, which Brundle isn't going to have. But it does make me wonder why we don't quite get that such with Button.
Yeah,
I think Button's just more of a casual commentator rather than a details thing. I think Nico's, it's just in his DNA that he's going to be that kind of a detail-focused kind of a commentator. I think in terms of ideal commentary teams, though, you just have to be thinking there of what some other duos would be, because I think two, maybe three is the absolute maximum you'd want at the same time. So I think in terms of duos, you've got to go to Alex Jakes and Alex Brundle, because they are just phenomenal for F2 and F3. So it'd be nice to see them in F1. Alex Jakes and Julian Palmer are great as well. I still would like both Brundles together on a broadcast at some point, just because I don't think that's going to happen for like a whole season or something, but that would just be fun. I know that BC still gets in the car whenever he gets the opportunity, and that obviously helps keep his knowledge of everything pretty fresh, like you were saying about Rosberg. So I think he should, I don't know who I'd partner him with, but I think he kind of fits well with anyone at this point. We saw that with the Formula E in Misano, he kind of popped in there and did commentary and seemed pretty on it and everything, and he got a chance to drive in the Gen 3 car. So it's that nice bit of overlap there. But again, I'm sure Harry Benjamin will thank you for wanting to put in with Nico Rosberg.
He's a good commentator, and of course cut his teeth on this podcast as a guest. Yeah. Anyway, after, of course, the sprint, we had qualifying for the main Grand Prix, which was about as to be expected, with a few sort of headline points coming out of it. Perez narrowly getting out of Q1 as well, nearly getting the run strategy wrong there, but had the pace in hand to get away with it. Sainz, interestingly, getting away with the red flag qualifying rule because he didn't have to be recovered. Seems to be the loophole that was sort of used.
I did want to ask this question. Is the red flag necessary here? And Carlos Sainz will say yes, because it allowed him to get back into that.
Yes, yeah, the red flag gave him enough time to sort of get the car going and utilize the hybrid system, sort of kick it over and get it running again and limp it back around to the pits, fresh tires, fresh wing, and away he goes again. But yeah, I think there was a bit of a kickoff from Aston Martin, I want to say, who were upset that he did not have his times cancelled and wasn't sort of excluded from the rest of the session for causing a red, which is supposed to be the new rule after... Interestingly, Sainz got tangled with Perez in Monaco two seasons back, wasn't it? And caused a red flag in a qualifying there. But yeah, I think he got away with that one because he was able to sort of recover himself. He didn't have to be recovered. I think that's roughly where the FIA drew the line on that one. So he got away with
my latest nail in Liberty F1 coffin is that in this era that I know is probably short-lived because of 2026 race, but in this era of, everything's going to be so wonderful, it's the first time since Mika Hakkinen in 1999 that a single driver has taken the first five pole positions of the year. And I was like, we don't even know these records exist until Max breaks them. It's ridiculous. And this is not meant to be the period of Formula One history. We're going to be finding all of this out. Quite frustrating, but Verstappen's 37th and Red Bull's 100th pole for the stat fans out there. So that was also kind of as good a place as any to do it in Shanghai, because again, it's a brand new circuit and Max hasn't really done much around it.
yeah, brand new, relatively well, brand new circuit for a vast amount of fans. It's one of the few circuits Max doesn't have a win at.
So I did feel old when people started asking on social media, "Oh, is this your first Chinese Grand Prix?" I'm like, "No, of course it's not."
It's the 20th year of having a Chinese Grand Prix. Also, so 20 years since the first Chinese Grand Prix, because of course the weird hiatus. But also,
I like driving around it.
But equally, obviously, we're saying sort of Red Bull 100 poles, fantastic. Remind me again how many pole positions Lewis Hamilton has, if you know off the top of your head.
103.
Yeah, so it sort of very quickly devalues that stat, and equally sort of revalues quite what Lewis is able to do.
Oh yeah, I mean, it's quite nice in some respects because it just shows you that whilst Max is this dominant, there's a whole other level of dominance in some respects. But it's just frustrating that in this specific era that was branded as, oh, it's going to be so amazing again, it's this is going to switch everything up into like, and we've broken a record from 20 years ago. Great.
How many did over 20 years ago.
How many did
91, I think. Oh, that was wins. I'm not sure on the polls.
Schumacher poles. Let's see. Michael Schumacher pole positions 68, which is not a bad record to have. But yeah, anyway, qualifying out the way, Hamilton stuck right down at the back of the field. Everything else as expected at the front. We jump into the Grand Prix and we'll open up the review for that with Red Bull. And Timo, you have an amusing word on Sergio Perez.
I'm not sure when over the weekend he said it, but he complained that he gets judged more harshly because of Verstappen being his teammate, which on the one hand I can partly understand because, you know, it's tricky if you're Bottas to Hamilton, Barrichello to Schumacher, you're going to have these potentially unfair comparisons. But then the thing that abused me about that was that in the Grand Prix then he couldn't get past Norris. And you're like, this was the perfect opportunity to then, at least if you're not going to take it to Verstappen, at least close that gap a little bit or show that you can beat everyone else. And he blamed it on strategy, he blamed it on the tires. I'm like, you're in a Red Bull. You're not a bad driver. You've won Grand Prix. You've been on the podium tons of times. You're meant to be like the Minister of Defence, and yet Norris just walks past you. Kind of a bit underwhelming from Perez there and a little bit tongue-in-cheek. It's like, you're regretting saying that at the start of the weekend now a little bit because that just kind of... He's having a good season to keep his seat, but it's just these little things here and there. I'm just like, it's better if you just don't say anything and just get on with the racing.
Yeah, I mean, he's only 9 points ahead of Charles Leclerc at the moment in constructor standings. Mm. Meanwhile, the gap to Verstappen ahead, 85 to 110, is 5 to 90, so it's 25 points. So basically, Perez is now a win.
He should win Miami for Verstappen DNFs, and it doesn't make a blind bit of difference.
Yeah, basically that would put them level.
And we're on race 5, for Christ's sake.
Yeah, so that's where that one stands, which is interesting.
I mean, it's not comparable because Verstappen will probably win all of the races, but Leclerc had a very big lead in 2022.
Yeah.
Not just diminished.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah.
That was from Max and not Carlos, so teammates, definitely.
Yeah.
Mm. Danny May, your thoughts on Red Bull's performance then across the weekend?
Sorry, I'm just shocking a Rennie. I thought it was interesting to see how sort of the Red Bull does struggle a bit when it's in dirty air with cars around it. I think in the sprint, Verstappen was somewhat wearing his tyres in nicely before having a go at those in front, and he did have those battery issues right at the start. But when sort of Perez was surrounded by the Ferraris and the Alonso, etc., I think that car doesn't like it, but once it has clear air, it's off. A bit sort of like how the Mercedes was.
In
the end of the other era.
Sort of the previous era where it was, the Mercedes hated having to work its way through a field because of its sort of aerodynamics. But as soon as it got free, it was able to disappear. The Red Bull doesn't struggle so much coming through the field, but once it is free, it just vanishes. And the rate at which Verstappen was able to disappear was phenomenal, really. This weekend, it was something else watching just the
game. I'm saying comparison was what? Best part of 14 seconds towards the end, and that's despite all of the pit stops and safety cars and whatnot. And then you look at, and again, I know we shouldn't always do this, but you look at IndyCar, the top five covered by less than 10 seconds.
Mm. It's a... yeah, an interesting balance of performance. I think for me, Perez just needs a little more something this year. I think there's nothing new to sell Max, but given, like you said, Timo, Perez's ability to sort of chase down and get to the back of Lando's McLaren is good, but there needs to be the next thing just to get him past that. And yeah, it doesn't matter if you sort of win by an inch or a mile.
As long as you beat him, it's kind of like Alonso in Brazil with Perez. It's this kind of thing like, I don't need to like overtake you and drive off into the distance. I'm going to get you on the last lap and be right dick about it because you're going to hate me for this, but everyone else is going to love me because what a move I've just done there. And that's what people will remember. They don't really care how much you win by as long as you win.
Mm. But you didn't even get near Norris to overtake him.
Well, that's the thing. He couldn't even do that.
No.
That's what I'm saying. That's why I'm so amused by him saying he gets compared unfavorably to Max. I'm like, don't worry about Max. Worry about getting past bloody Norris, the guy that's not even won a Grand Prix yet or a sprint, and you can't get past him because you blame the tyres and the strategy. You're one of the most experienced drivers on the grid. Just go and do it. Stop moaning.
Maybe the death of Brad Bird's cousin earlier today was a bit too much weighing on his mind, and that was distracting him from it all. So you did see that he hit a bird during, was it practice? And he made a joke about it to Brad Bird, his race engineer. Or was I the only person?
I have no idea what any of you just said.
Oh, at some point, across the weekend, Sergio Perez ran into a bird on track and joked over the radio. They said, oh, have you hit a bird? Do you think you've got damage? He went, no, I don't think so. Do you think it was your cousin? Because, of course, his race engineer is Brad Bird.
I think you should focus on the driving rather than the humour.
Yeah, that's clearly where a lot of his energy is going. Anyway, Ferrari. Timo, your thoughts on Ferrari?
It's a mixed bag, weirdly, because I expected more from them. But it's a good thing that I'm annoyed with them, because if I'm annoyed at them for P4 and P5, it shows how good they've been doing so far this season. And they kind of had a bit of a... I mean, they could have had a much worse weekend. I mean, Leclerc's crash in sprint quali. Carlos is more of a crash in actual qualifying. And then Carlos very much deciding, I'm not really playing the team game this year. I'm going to race Leclerc as hard as I can because I want to prove to you that you made a mistake in which driver you're keeping. It could have been so calamitous for them, but they had decent strategy. They maximized it. They should have probably been ahead of Norris, but again, that's just one of those things. But again, P4, P5, solid. So I'm just happy I'm annoyed with them because I'm annoyed with them for a good reason this time. And it's not something that is kind of like I'm like clawing my eyes out going, why did you not do this? Why not this? It's just I'm disappointed P4 and P5. It's quite nice to, because normally we'd just be, if this was last year, like, hell yeah. All right, P4, P5. Well, let's go.
Yeah, we're sort of upset because we know the performance that's in that car and what they're able to achieve. I think overall,
Carlos Sainz isn't on the podium. What's wrong?
It's good, however, to see the fact that Ferrari are closer to Red Bull ahead of them than they are McLaren behind them. There's a bigger gap working backwards than there is forwards. So there's games still to be played there, certainly when you look at Perez's performance, as we've already discussed, and the fact that the Ferraris do seem to be very competitive when they're on it. And this weekend, I just think they struggled a bit with their tyres. They've obviously got a car that's a lot kinder to it, and that wasn't quite the setup you needed this weekend. They weren't able to turn it on quite so aggressively, and the net result was sort of, yeah, Charles being able to make the one stop work again, much like he did in Japan, but it sort of hampered their running, I think, across the weekend. Ellie May, what do you think about the Ferrari performances?
Yeah, you both have kind of covered it. They weren't sort of quite on the pace this weekend, and it was kind of messy in places, but it wasn't the worst that they could have done either. Mm. It's still a good amount of points.
Especially with the late safety cars, the VSC going into an SC, it's great to see that their strategy and their pit wall is plastic enough to sort of deal with those sudden changes in a race as well. They're not left panicking going, plan P, Q, maybe R. I don't know. They've got...
Well, you sort of hear plan D for Friday.
D, but they seem confident when they say plan D and the drivers are happy to go for plan D.
They always sound confident when they say it, but we just don't trust them by instinct.
But the drivers are a bit more toned to what they know plan D is and how it will play out on track. There's a bit more confidence from the driving side of it. The pit wall always said, we're going for plan D. And you sort of go, oh, that sounds good. And the drivers sort of go, are you sure? There's not as much of the are you sure in the drivers, which is great to know. There's been a proper discussion beforehand and an understanding between both the drivers and the pit wall, and equally the pit wall being able to react appropriately and promptly to when things change on track, is a sign of the work that's been put in by Vasseur to sort of restructure the important and very sort of weekend heavy parts of the team.
It's not the engineers going on radio saying, what do you think about plan something either. Yeah. Going plan D and then being like, okay.
It's not Seb Vettel going into a sort of an hour long sort of mathematics argument about sort of if my tyres are degrading at X percent per lap and I've got this many laps to complete on this compound and then that the X many laps left to do, which compound do you think I should be pitting onto and at what lap? It's sort of very much a case of a good understanding. We know if things change, this is what we can do. Do you agree with this? And the drivers both nod and go, yeah, no, that sounds good. We have faith in you this time round. Meanwhile, at Mercedes, I think this was a really good drive from Lewis Hamilton. Qualifying was a shocker, admittedly, but given how competent that car is, certainly his chassis is, I think this was a fairly good drive from Lewis.
Qualifying obviously didn't go to plan, but watching Lewis afterwards, it kind of told you everything you need to know about it because he wasn't annoyed with it. He was like, well, we knew we weren't going to do well, so George went in one direction, I went another. We thought one of us is going to get this right. Wasn't me this time. I'll have a bit of fun tomorrow. And he's in that very much of, you can tell he's leaving the team at the end of the season because he doesn't really care. But at the same time, he does care and he got to have a bit of fun out there. And I think that P9, as painful as it is to see a driver of his caliber down in that position, is probably where at least one of those drivers would have ended up at come the end of the race anyway. So they didn't really lose anything and they at least gained valuable information about what not to do. And what to do in some respects with Russell, even though whatever direction they went in didn't change much in a way to improve it, it just didn't make it worse. And he dropped off signs a bit towards it, which is a shame because it looked like he might be on for that. But yeah, it's a result that looks deceptively bad, but is somewhat encouraging in a weird way that is still disappointing for that to be encouraging for Mercedes, but we've got to take what we can at this point for them.
Yeah, it looks bad on paper, but once you add the context to it and know where they started from, the different chassis dev routes they're going down, it makes a hell of a lot more sense. George went a bit...
We're looking at details. People aren't going to be happy with us on the internet looking at details. They just like to jump to conclusions.
But George went a bit missing through the race, a bit like Piastri later, because there's nothing really special about his drive, but there's nothing truly pants about it either. It was just sort of competent. And I think at the end of the day, when you're sort of going through a Mercedes car that's developing hugely through a season, that's the best you can get away with, is just having a really competent drive and going away with a hell of a lot more data to go into Miami with. Ellie May, do you concur?
Yeah, I mean, I know there's other variable factors, like they, you know, changed their setup, but why that car seems to be so different in qualifying modes, I'm not sure. But in terms of racing, it seems to be that it just doesn't like high fuel loads. And I think that's why we perhaps were able to see them have a better sprint. And then they then sort of, when in the race, they seem to be better nearer the end, and that car also just hated turning. The understeer was so bad.
Fighting to get the nose into the corner. I think the McLaren was struggling with it as well. There was a sort of message from Lando's pit wall going, adjust the brake balance to try and sort of quell, was it corner entry steer or something with sort of rear brake bias across the axle and differential locking, and he said, no, thank you. Because he also knew that at that point it was going to start cooking the rear tyres. It was going to put more load through the rears. So it was a demanding circuit that really did see a lot from pit walls and race engineers as much as it did from drivers. I mentioned Lando again there. So we'll dive into McLaren. Timo, you've got a little less of a positive aspect on him.
I'm just so frustrated with him at this point because he just seems far too content with second place. He came out after the race saying, whenever we finish behind Max, it feels like a win. How? How as a racing driver can you be satisfied with that? I know it's Max Verstappen, but you ask someone like Alonso in that car, or Piastri given in a few years' time, or Lewis, or Max even, or Carlos, and like Peter, like, yeah, it's great, but it's not a win, it's not first place, it's not what it is. And good strategy by the team. Got to give the hats off to them for helping to put him in that position. But I feel like they probably don't get as much credit as they'll deserve, and Lando will get more of it. And it's like, well, no, he's meant to be able to know how to drive it, and well done, he can listen to the team he's been in bed with for a good few years now. And I mean, I said already about what I think in terms of how he lost the start for the sprint. So I don't need to go over that. But again, it just the difference for me there between McLaren and Norris as a team versus Verstappen and Red Bull as a team, and even Lewis and Mercedes as a team, was very evident in those race starts there and how quickly he seemed to lose that and seemed pretty content with just, I'll be in P2. And that's good enough. I've beaten one Red Bull and it's Perez, so that counts just about. But I'm not going to bother going after the win. And you saw this in Texas, I feel like, last year as well. He didn't fight Max at all when he came past him. Lewis tried to take P12. Oh, he suddenly wakes up and he starts fighting. I'm like, what? Where was that? Like 2 minutes ago when Max was coming past you. Why are you not trying to fight him? Like, you're probably going to lose anyway, but everyone else would try this. And I think this was the thing that, just as an overarching race comment, was the most frustrating thing for me to have Norris in P2 and Perez in P3, because you've got the two drivers there who are not going to take it to Max at all, because Perez, he's been neutered at this point. He's not going to do it. And Norris doesn't appear to know how to. And it was an amusing conversation I was having with Jacob post-race, saying, oh, but what if Stroll was in P2 and Sargeant was in P3? They probably wouldn't do it. He's like, probably not. But the fact that they'd even be there in the first place means you've had a somewhat interesting race at least to get at that point. And they might be more likely to try and risk something if they were able to, because they're in this rarefied atmosphere that they've never experienced before. Whereas Norris, for someone who really wants that win, just doesn't show it enough for me at the moment.
I think the problem he encounters is trying to chase down and close up that gap. You can't just put your foot down and drive close and magic your way to the back.
It would be nice to see some kind of, if you're able to do that, at least then out of the car when you're having the interviews and whatever, be a bit more punchy and don't just say, yeah, it felt like a win in P2.
But every driver is saying that this season. This isn't a Lando-specific thing. Every driver has come out and said, look, if we're coming home P2, if we're coming home behind the Red Bulls, that is the best we can hope for. Because every team at the moment
every other driver that's finished in P2 has won a race before.
Yeah, because they've been Sergio Perez or Carlos Sainz.
Charles Leclerc as well. Not second place, but...
But yeah, that's the thing. Like, all the other teams and drivers have certainly up until sort of, I want to hazard a guess at something like Austria, have all pretty much confined themselves to sort of saying, look, if we are P2, if we've got a driver in P2, P3, and P3, we've done well. If we're coming home as the second highest scoring team this weekend, we have done well. Because they know they cannot hold a torch to Verstappen and that Red Bull. And there's no
point. I think it just frustrates me because you see other drivers admittedly low down the grid fighting harder for a position.
Fighting harder for lower places. But you're not going
to throw
away.
Sure that Norris, I don't know. It's just maybe it's the personality thing with Norris at the moment that he just seems so far too happy with P2 and yet has this reputation for being one of the best of the best. You're like, you're not even fighting or trying to fight for a win and doesn't come across as you're disappointed with it. Like, fine, be happy with P2, but don't give off this jubilant expression with it. It just doesn't gel and sit right there for me.
For you,
I think it's finding that fine balance. You know, Norris probably and obviously does want to win a race, but when you have Max Verstappen up behind you, you're deciding, right, well, if I fight him on a track that, you know, will hurt my tires, if I do fight him, is that then going to push me back into the...
I'm glad you brought that up then, because I think for me, and again, maybe it's just a personality difference and he's perfectly content doing his thing and fine to do it, whatever. But if I'm in his position where I've trained my entire life to be here, I'm in a car and a team that has been improving over the last couple of years or so, and I'm getting these kind of opportunities to be on the podium again where I'm not expecting to be, I would rather, I know I can't just necessarily put my foot down and go after Max, but I'd rather try and close that gap as much as possible and sacrifice P2 to then maybe have to slip down to P3, hell, even P4, and think, you know what, I tried it, but I'd rather have tried it and not completely succeeded, but still managed to get something out of it, because I'll still be probably in a better position than I was expecting to be at the start of this race, than just sit back and be like, P2's fine, I guess.
But then there's a double-edged sword then of people that would then go, oh, he's fought Verstappen for the win. That was stupid. He's now hurt himself and now he's gone down to fourth or fifth when he could have got a second.
Yeah. So maybe, but I'd kind of have more respect for him as a racing driver, though, because it shows that you're actually willing to go out to go and race rather than just
fruitless.
Drive.
That's fruitless to do that, because all you're going to do is then start to tumble down the order. We've seen that previously.
Well, not necessarily. Well, again, you've got to weigh it up, but I'm saying if you work it out and you think, I'm going to drop back maybe to fourth at worst, then fine. I'm not saying if you come down over the point, then obviously don't do that. But I'm saying you can't say there's not people back at Woking, back with the team, who don't have the capabilities to work out some of these things, to at least talk it over. Maybe they did and we just didn't hear about it, but it just doesn't feel like there's that stuff going on there, and I feel like that's something that the team's missing as an overall thing to try and get them back nearer the front.
But when you, I mean, you compare the two McLaren drivers, and you know, we know Piastri is a very good driver, but you look at the racecraft over this weekend and Norris was a lot quicker than Piastri, and I know Piastri perhaps maybe had a gearbox issue in the sprint because they then changed it, I believe. But Piastri did struggle a lot more than Norris this weekend on race pace. And part of me wonders whether, going back to sort of that rear traction problems, we heard Lando's engineer obviously give the prompt to use engine braking to help with that, and Lando said no, because it hurts the rear tyres too much. And I wonder whether Oscar was perhaps doing that or something similar, and that's why he wasn't particularly matching Lando, because maybe he was just cooking his tyres a bit more.
I say on that, he had damage from the incident we'll get to in a minute, partly, and then obviously as well the gear was saying, but also brand new track for him. It's his second year versus Lando's, what, sixth year now or something silly. So there's obviously a massive kind of, you'd be surprised if Norris wasn't still ahead of Piastri in a lot of ways, especially this kind of a circuit where everything's kind of, like you were saying, Jesse, you've got such fluctuating performances for both cars over the weekend in different conditions and whatnot. It's kind of, they even came into the weekend going, we don't think this will suit us. So kind of, they were surprised as much as anyone, but I don't know. I think it might just be a personality thing, but I think it's a thing I've got with a lot of the drivers this year, is this whole thing, as well as from before. I mean, it's interesting for me to reference one Pablo Montoya, but he always said that whenever Michael would be making his way up through the grid, lots of drivers would just part the seas for him and let him past. And it seems that Verstappen has the same thing with Montoya. He was like, I'd fight him because, yeah, I might not win it, but why should I let him past? And it feels like that's what I want from a race with Grand Prix drivers. You're meant to be the best in the world. Act like it and at least give it a go. And if you're half as good as you say, even if you drop down the order, you'd be able to recover half as well as you can. Because, I mean, look at Alonso, and then towards the end of the race, he had to pit. Look at Ricciardo early on in the race. Pitted, was jumped down the order. He was about 5 seconds off Yuki and a couple of others around that. Kind of, there was a decent enough buffer on time-wise. A couple of laps later, passed them, and Alonso was hunting down, what was it, Piastri or Russell towards the end, and was going after it. Like, that is the racing I'm on about. And it feels like that's lacking from drivers that actually are maybe capable of at least challenging Max. I'm not saying you've got to beat him, but at least make the gap not 14 seconds.
There is a strange resignation amongst the drivers, but certainly one of those drivers there isn't is Fernando Alonso at Aston Martin. And Timo, I'll give you a break, your voice a break for a second. Now, I'll go with my point of Alonso really showing why he's still in the sport. The opening move on Perez really showed his tenacity, but I mean, the car doesn't back him up as much as he needs it to. It really sort of cooked through its tyres early on, and he then eventually had to sort of cede that place back to Perez. But the fact that he was able to sort of really get up there, get it going, and put a fight in shows that there's a lot of life left in the not really that old dog at this point in time. And
mature dog.
Yeah, mature dog. But equally, it's something that looks really good on him when you compare him to the other side of the Aston Martin garage. And for once, I'm going to side with Daniel Ricciardo on something. And I think the Stroll slam train is, yeah, purely that. It is Lance Stroll just not having the edge that the drivers around him do. And it's funny that that all happened after we joked about putting condoms on the front of cars for that exact reason.
I thought the exact same. But it's also the way, I guess, Stroll conducted himself after putting, you know, he put pretty much all the blame on Ricciardo, saying he brake-tested him and then whatnot. And Yes, the cars were a little bit too close together, but no one else went into each other. If anything, Stroll had the biggest gap and more of a reaction time to brake, but he wasn't looking at the cars ahead of him. It was his mistake, and he doesn't want to own up to it.
Well, that's exactly what Oscar Piastri had to say afterwards, was he said, yeah, there were loads of cars in a really tight train, but no one else crashed into anyone.
I do love Piastri's just understated way of just commenting on stuff and just like this low-key sarcastic... mean cures thing, just like, I'm just going to drop this in here and I'm going to walk away.
Yeah, that just sounds
he's
like
so
a
even... He's so Gen Z.
He very much is.
But I mean, Stroll as well, saying he doesn't understand why he got a penalty. I'm like, really? You don't understand that? Literally, I mean, what, there was nowhere for him to go. Car in front of you, empty track right here. Turn. Maybe that would solve the problem. I thought during the IndyCar race, I don't know how much of it you two watched, but the incident with Jack Harvey, where the car kind of just collected him, was like, that's the definition of not having anywhere to go. He literally can't do anything about that. This car has just crashed into him, and he's tried avoiding it. There's nowhere else to go. There's a wall.
Yeah, it was one that of the rookies, unavoidable. That suffered a sort of suspension failure after he tapped the wall earlier. Yeah,
and the car then comes round Ricardo him. After the... after the race when, or after he'd gone out of the race rather than he was told, because he was pretty upbeat and everything. He was like, it's a shame, but I had a great weekend. And then he was told what Stroll had been saying. And just, I like this kind of feisty Danny Rick in comments, because it's the whole thing of kind of very much Piastri as well, of this, oh, ever so sarcastic slightly. Well, apparently I'm an idiot and it was my fault. The only thing you've got to do in that situation is watch the car in front of you. I'm doing my best not to say what I want to say, but fuck that guy. I'm like, yeah, we're all thinking that, to be honest with you. It's just like, how Stroll is still there, continues to baffle me every time. And as I say in the notes here, literally put anything else in that car, it could not get worse.
Put me in it. Go on. Give me a shout.
Why?
But you wouldn't rear-end Ricardo. No. You'd know that, oh, this is happening. I yeah, might just I'll see this wheel in front of me that I used to turn the car. I might just use that instead of...
I mean, it's bold to assume I'd be right up the back of Ricardo. I'd sort of be around the Logan Sargeant area, I'd hazard a guess at. But even then, the concept remains but
again, you wouldn't just rear-end him.
No. And if I was, I'd put a condom on.
I also want to know... why Aston Martin is so obsessed with putting softs on randomly during a race when it isn't in any way optimal.
That was such a strange move.
Just,
it was such a strange strategy.
Like, the thing is, they'd
served two compounds by that point as well. So they're like, should we just go in third? What, like completing? Are you just aiming for stats at this point? I don't know.
And then they're going to have to do another pit stop because that's not going to last. And
even
you
with
were,
the safety cars, those softs wouldn't last.
No. You were in third at the start of the race. How have you lost this so badly?
Yeah, very strange weekend for Aston Martin. Great if you're Fernando Alonso. Bit weird if you're the Aston Martin pit wall. And a bit shoddy if you're Lance Stroll, really. But speaking of shoddy weekends. It's every weekend. Speaking of shoddy weekends, Minardi.
Sorry, I know I keep interrupting you, but I was reminded about that Hammond joke from Top Gear. Just imagine waking up every morning remembering you're Lance Stroll.
It'd be great because you could go back to sleep again because you don't really have to go to work.
True.
Anyway, we'll move on to another team that had a shoddy weekend, but its drivers were doing all right. Minardi, Visa Cash App, Toro Rosso, whatever we're still calling them. I think it was a bit of a rough weekend for both drivers. Tsunoda struggling with the rubber on the aggressive and new-to-him circuit. And then, of course, Ricciardo getting Punterino from Stroll was just damned unlucky. He was on for a decent result. I don't think he was going to get points.
It's like Lewis. It's a better weekend than you think because everyone's saying about Ricciardo's troubles and whatnot, but this seemed to be like they came with improvements for the car that he was asking for, with what they were saying needs to be tailored for him to feel more at home with this car, and it clearly worked. I mean, he outperformed Yuki in every single session, P9, P12, P14, P19, P11, P16, P12, P19, and yeah, double DNF in the end, but not Ricciardo's fault in any way, shape or form. And as I said earlier, Yuki jumped him in the first set of pit stops, I think it was, and there was that 5 or 7 second gap between Yuki and a few of the drivers around him, and then Ricciardo. And Ricciardo just I was worried about that because I thought, oh, this is where we've seen some struggles recently with those, with both of those cars making their way back up through where we've seen them. And he just went on by in a couple of laps. I'm like, oh, sweet. This is, we might be on for something here. And he could have been in that P10, P9 situation towards the end, potentially. Great pace on him. So it's a really frustrating thing that Stroll exists. And hopefully Miami can bounce back. But you said about Yuki, yeah, he struggled a little bit of nowhere. But again, it was new track for other drivers, including Piastri, and still did all right considering. So it's just interesting how which new drivers coped better, because it's still not, it's obviously not a Red Bull copy, that RB, but it's not anywhere near as bad as it has been. It's not an Alpine.
Yeah.
So it was curious to see that he had such a significant drop off from one race to the next, even though it was new. So you kind of thought he'd maybe be, maybe not even in the points, but he'd be higher up in not in the points, if that makes sense. He'd kind of be maybe P13, P14 care area instead of at the back.
Mm. I think with some upgrades, that Minardi is going to be a lot closer to the Haas, and we're going to have an interesting battle between those four as the season goes on. Ellie May, do you think it was a decent weekend for them overall, or was there still something to be shown?
I mean, I guess the only positive really is to take away is that Ricciardo did have a much better weekend of it. Tsunoda sort of struggled all weekend, but he was coming back in the race until he got shunted by Magnussen. But in terms of Ricciardo, despite him doing pretty well, I don't really understand what strategy RB were pushing him on. We obviously didn't get to see how it would have played out because he got strolled, but I think the strategy they were on would have ultimately hurt Ricciardo and what was a good performance this weekend. And I think that would have been, it would have taken him out of the points because he still had to, after that safety car, pit because he had already had, he'd had the same compound of tyres.
I had been hoping they'd pit him before the safety car like a few others did, and then they didn't. I was kind of frustrated that they didn't do that because he'd have to do all that work again.
So I think that would have almost ruined what was a good
potentially.
Yeah.
But another, positives anyway.
Yes.
Another good weekend partially ruined. The Sauber and... Yeah, I'm going to break form and agree with Timo on this one, so I'll let you say your words.
What have I written down? I need to check it. It's kind of, they as a team kind of summed up my thoughts on the Grand Prix as a whole here. There's more potential than expected, and none of it really delivered. And it was a shame for Bottas because he could have had a point. He was close to, he was quite a nice surprise in qualifying. Both of them were quite a nice surprise in sprint qualifying and setting up for the race. And it's one of those typical things. Joe finishes a P9 in the sprint, and if it had been any other race, that would have been excellent. But it's a sprint. So you don't get shit. And it was nice to see Joe at home, but I kind of questioned if we needed to see him on the grid at the end, but I suppose they do that for some drivers occasionally, and this might be his only opportunity to race at home, so I don't mind it too much, but it did feel very much in the same way that this whole potentially rejigging of the point system is meant to distract you from what's actually going on, of like, here's a nice moment for social media. Ignore the race. Here's a nice moment for social media.
I don't mind the nice moment. Chinese driver to therefore have a home race. And,
well, I think it's monumental.
Just the cynic in me.
Yeah, I think it was nice to see it, and it clearly meant a lot to him as well. And it was nice to see the respect that his sport gave him, as in sort of the organisers and everything, putting everything together. It was nice to see that actual respect there and the understanding of what he'd achieved by getting to that level. I think is nice to see. And equally the fan support as well, the fact that the amount of fans that sort of go, yeah, it's our home driver that we've never had one of these guys before. Go him. So that was really good.
I was going to say, if you're Stroll, you're probably quite glad you didn't rear-end him, because good luck getting out of Shanghai, never mind China, alive after that.
I won't go on to make comment about that. But yeah, minus 1,000 social points for Stroll. But yes, a good dash of performance from the stake across the weekend. And yeah, like you said, Zhou's sprint drive was pretty solid. And had it been any other race, that would have been points. And
we've seen this before from those kind of teams. They perform at just the wrong time. And like, God, damn it, why do you not do that during the race normally?
Yeah, but yeah, I think overall it was decent for them. But the reliability issues creeping in concern me. And they still haven't got the pit stops down pat. There are still problems. I mean, it's not Alpine bad, but it's still a bit sort of suspect.
They were quicker, though.
Joe had a 5-second stop.
And 5 seconds was his longest, I believe.
Yeah, which is good for them.
But yeah, I agree with you both. It could have been a really promising weekend for them, and it's a shame they weren't able to exploit that. They both did annoyingly really well in the sprint qualifying and the sprint, and you know, Bottas did quite well in qualifying. It's a shame that Joe couldn't do that as well, but it's also as much as a shame that Bottas is doing really well in the qualifying and then the race nothing came to fruition of it as his engine just went kaput. And yeah, it's a shame Joe didn't get ninth in the race, because then that would have, you know, sort of been the cherry on top of the cake of his home race, just to, you know, finishing the points.
Meanwhile, another Ferrari powered team, Haas, and just sort of slowly catchy monkey accruing points across the season, which we sort of like to see from them.
Yeah, great from both drivers there. And again, kind of reiterating what I was saying about Alonso and a couple others earlier, K-Mag, despite the penalties, it was just nice to see him actually making moves and actually racing, going for stuff and trying stuff, because we just don't get too much of that at the moment. Outside of that Silverstone reference in the sprint, we didn't really get much else in that race. And in the Grand Prix, there wasn't too much of it either. So it's just nice that they're trying, and Holt getting a point again is just a little bit there. And 2 points between them and RB now, they've got to take advantage of that kind of situation the best that they can. And they did. And that's going to really count towards the end of the year, I think. And it's going to be fascinating to see what happens there, because at the moment, if things go as they are, those two are going to be battling out for best of the rest, essentially. And if you'd asked us which two teams would be doing that at the start of this year, we'd have probably said Alpine and Williams. So the fact that it's RB and Haas is a pleasant surprise.
It did amuse me during the race when you had Magnussen and Stroll fighting at it, just as both of them had taken out both RBs. It just amused me.
I mean, we did ask you at the start of the season, Timo, and you did say that Minardi and Haas would be fighting one another, but you said they'd be fighting each other in 8th and 9th. So a little bit
lower. They're still
tough. Yeah, a little bit lower down the order. Perhaps Stake and Williams will get their act in gear. Although, I'm looking at this now, I'm concerned about the magical, mystical drinks you're drinking to predict Alpine 10th.
Ooh.
Oh, indeed. Yeah. So we'll see what happens there. In the meantime, I think it's a great race from Hülkenberg. A little bit too racy at points, sort of bit too on the fine edge of things, a little bit clumsy from K-Mag. But otherwise, there's the bones of a really good outfit there, and it's slowly coming together and being worked in something a lot more practical each weekend. So, yeah.
And very briefly, you got to see Magnussen's cool camera on his car again that we saw in Japan. That was nice.
His cool what?
Camera that he's got just on the...
the rear facing one.
It's a slightly different angle toward the one... No, front facing, but it's just a slightly different position, but it kind of gives you a little bit more scope and everything that we saw in Japan. It was very nice on board, and none of the teams seem to have that. So like, oh, yes.
They're sort of fiddling around and trying different camera angles, which I quite like. Meanwhile, speaking of fiddling around and finding a bit of success, Alpine.
Because, yes...
They got to Q2. That's it. That's all I've got.
Yes, they were better, but both of them, were almost better equally. And seeing as they rushed through the upgrades on Ocon's car, have they really then made an improvement? I guess it's a little early to tell, because Alpine only really had one free practice session to try and understand how the new upgrades work on the car, and maybe they don't have the optimal setup yet, and we'll see it more in Miami. But for me... Yes, it was better, but it's kind of worrying how for me anyway, Gasly and Ocon was sort of on a similar pace, and Ocon's going to have those upgrades.
Mm. the upgrades haven't really sort of separated them too much. And yeah, making it into Q2, close to the points, it's better. But I mean, still tangling with Williams, who we've sort of accidentally scrolled past on our list of notes. And Timo, you've got very short, sort of 5 words about them this weekend.
Well, yeah, because I mean, at least they didn't crash.
There we go. Enough said. Sargent struggling all weekend. Albon held back by the chassis, duking it out with the Alpines. It was just sort of an performance from Williams at a weekend where they could have had a lot to gain, especially with a few retirements up ahead in the field. Albon just wasn't in the right place at the right time to sort of capitalise on those, I don't think.
Yeah, I don't really have much to say on Williams, really. Sargent struggled and sort of Alex got a bit punchy, but it never really led to
anything.
Getting up. Yeah.
There were a few moments where he was sort of being pushed wide on track, pushing others wide on track, really getting their elbows out, but just sort of vanished a bit on the sort of broadcast feed and got lost from there onwards. So we'll dive into then from the W for Williams to the W for winners and indeed spinners. And winner, we'll go for Ellie May.
I've gone for Lando Norris. He was, what, 1 and a bit seconds faster than anyone else in sprint qualifying. So he didn't have the best of sprints, but he came back in qualifying to get it on the second row and off the grid and made the one-stop strategy work incredibly well. And Perez never really got near him. So the pace is kind of there.
Yeah, for being able to show up Perez, I think it's a worthy winner this weekend. Timo?
Fernando Alonso. Just because, yeah, he didn't finish as high up as he should have from where he started, but he clawed his way back considering the bizarre strategy he was on, and he was racy, and he did a very nice save. Kind of, you thought Carlos Sainz's save was good on that part of the track. Fernando Alonso could have been like, I took that personally. I'm going to do you one better. And this is how it's actually done, Sonny boy. And yeah, very nicely done towards the end. Just kind of showed that, oh, you're in race cars. You can overtake each other and race. That's... yes, of course you can. And you're Fernando Alonso, so why wouldn't you? Thank you very much.
I mean, if you want nice slidey abouty bits, you see Max Verstappen sort of drifting the car towards the end. Mm. So you're just sort of getting bored.
I thought you were going for a NASCAR reference.
No, he was sort of just drifting around, sort of showing off to GP on the radio. Mm. Meanwhile, for me, I think my winner's got to be Hamilton. It's a bit easy to gloss over, as I've already mentioned, but the Mercedes is still pretty poor. The setup wasn't there. Everyone was struggling with DRS traffic as well, which is a crucial thing with the huge straits in China. So sort of getting caught in DRS trains is a nightmare. But Lewis proved why he is a 7-time champ and an easy to underrate drive from him. So yeah, winner for me. Other side of the coin though are spinners. And Timo, I think we can let you start with yours because it's relatively obvious.
Short and sweet because my spinner is King Lance Stroll.
Thank you very much. Ellie May, your spinner.
RB, because, well, Yuki struggled all weekend, but was obviously coming back nicely in the race, but then Magnussen's dive up on the inside of him was never going to work, and it just took him out of the race.
It might have worked.
I don't think it was going to. It feels like you're sort of spinning RB for that one, despite the fact that Magnussen was the one that made the lunge. It was more like a Magnussen spinner, if anything.
Yeah. Well, I think... Yuki was almost already kind of my spinner for just for the fact that how much he struggled throughout this weekend. And then it ended up then being RB in general, just for the fact that Ricciardo then got taken out by Stroll and they just didn't have the best of race strategies either. So I think that's what they need to improve on as well.
For me, my spinner has to be Stake, and they could have had something... There could have been something. There was some decent pace on show at points, but they really failed to string it all together. And it worries me a bit about what they'll do when they become Audi, because I think a lot of this stems down to a personnel thing as well. Their inability to put together competent race strategies, to do pit stops. There's something that's missing there. And equally, we saw flashes of pace in qualifying. Why didn't you have your drivers towing one another around the circuit? Any other team, if they noticed that sort of ability, would have had the cars running 2x2 and using the long straights to really capitalise on things. But there just wasn't that sort of gumption from Stake to do that this weekend. And there's a little something missing from them for me. So I want to see more. There's a little spark of something. And Bottas said it earlier. He feels that he's had some good drives, but they've just sort of been let down by the team around him and the uncompetitive car. And I think he's right.
It's a way to get yourself a new contract.
Yeah. sort of go to anyone and go, look, I'm driving really well, but trust me, this thing's a piece of shite.
I think his, with his personality now and everything, he would be so much better suited to IndyCar or NASCAR.
Yeah, he's...
He'd have a lot more success. He'd have a lot more fun. He can clock in and clock out like he's doing here, and he'd free up a seat for someone who would really want to try and do something with that with Audi.
Yeah, I think certainly IndyCar would really, he'd really settle in there. There's a big Scandi sort of
all the V8 supercars down Oz.
All V8 supercars to simply sort of stick it down there and doesn't have to worry about moving with his partner too far.
They've Stake have got two very marketable drivers in the Bottas's personality at the minute, and Joe has the whole of China backing him.
Very marketable drivers. Like, this is Bottas's ability to market himself and sort of sell himself based on what he can offer commercially, I think now outweighs what he can offer as a driver. And that's possibly one of the reasons why he's sticking around and why he might still have offers to come. It's sort of very much the opposite of Kimi Raikkonen, where his driving had gone not necessarily down the pan, but it certainly wasn't as sharp as the others around him. But also, there wasn't quite the same marketability with Kimi Raikkonen. He just sort of refused to be the ad man's tool, whereas Bottas is quite happy to sort of play the Joker.
You knew you'd always get something decent out of Kimi in terms of performance, even if it wasn't as good as it used to be. So it's kind of, they figured they'd kind of either have marketability or performance, but they haven't figured out they can have both yet.
Yeah, which I think Bottas certainly still has the performance in him. He's still got that will to drive.
But the team haven't figured out how to do that with a car outfit. So they're like, we've got a driver who could give us this, but then we don't know how to do that either. So we'll just focus on marketing him instead.
Yeah, we'll make him do the funny videos. Anyway, we'll move into our predictions review. And there's a few points from this weekend for myself, Ellie May, and our sort of pseudo-guests of Nathan and Jonathan. Points across the board for Ellie May, Nathan, and Jonathan for the Verstappen pole, and then points for Ellie May, myself, Nathan, and Jonathan for the Verstappen win. No points for second or third, no points for fastest lap, and no points at all for the wild predictions. Clearly, we went a little bit too wild for Shanghai with our guesses there. Meanwhile, in the F1 review, I'm really wondering how long we can leave Noah Hunger in this league before we have to flag up that clearly there's been some dodgy dealing, because 432 points in Hunger 2 and Hunger 3 with the perfect possible lineup you could have, which was outside of budget all the way through. So I'm like, sus. So our actual sort of winner from the Chinese Grand Prix round was Lecresse, my mate Dan, 363 points. But I don't know if he knows that, if he's listening, or if he's checked, because he's currently stuck on the Pakistan-India border cycling to Bangkok. So
probably got priorities.
Yeah, other things going on.
I feel like they earned more points this weekend than the Greatest Mustache has in total.
Yeah, I was having a look through this earlier, and it was quite amusing me how solidly that's clinched on to P37 overall out of 37.
388 points was what your Greatest Mustache has overall, and they've earned 432. So they're a long
in one race.
Those with facial hair are not doing well.
No. There are struggles abreast there. Meanwhile, Jaffa Cake Racing P8 this weekend, Extra Magnifico Terrestrii P13, Team Nitro RX P19, and Timo's Podcast Team P37 for a random selection of teams.
I just see who was in my podcast team. So I thought, I must have done really badly then. I was like, it's not a bad lineup. It was just bad luck. It was just an odd weekend. It's like, I didn't actually do anything wrong.
I had that with one of my teams. It just didn't do great this weekend. It was Mid-Beds Racing, just didn't have it. I was like, 182 points this weekend. Not what I mean.
Speaking of Jaffa Cakes, went into Tesco's today to get some. It's actually there to get some cucumber and hummus because, you know, I'm trying to eat healthy, trying to get a summer body.
You came back with Jaffa Cakes. We understand. Continue.
Jaffa Cakes were on offer. You can get 33 for £2. So
it's a lot of Jaffa Cakes for not a lot of money.
Yeah.
That's a deal I might have to go and take up. Anyway, overall in the standings, unsurprisingly, Noah Honga 3 and Noah Honga 2 at the top of the list with 1,300 points and 1,185 points, with Take a Stroll in third place, 1,172 points, one of the more legitimate teams that doesn't seem to have somehow blown the budget. Ellie May's pod team is in P10, Timo's Nitro X podcast P11, JB Racing P14, and the Greatest Mustache clinging on desperately to P37 with the competition.
I really want to make a whole new account and a new team and enter it after the summer break
to see if you
and
can
see if I can get over with P37 there.
Anyway, that wraps up our review of the Chinese Grand Prix. We'll be back in about a week's time or so ahead of the Miami Grand Prix as we head back to the Hard Rock Stadium racing circuit and the sort of hope that it might be interesting once more. Again, it's hope.
And Ben, you remember it's Miami.
Yeah. Ahead of that, though, Timo, where can people find you in the meantime?
I'm just going to do the one plug this time because we've got a lot of stuff going on. So the Nitro RX podcast, we've got a lot of fun interviews coming out there. We've had one out today, for example, and we've got some more great stuff coming there over the next few weeks. So exciting times in the off-season in the world of Nitro Cars.
Excellent. Ellie May, where can people find you between now and the Miami Grand Prix?
The dentist.
Okay, she's going to the dentist. That's interesting. Mm-hmm. And in the meantime, if you want more from me, you can find me, of course, writing for Classic Car Weekly. Our latest issue will be out for sale on Wednesday. We have got 40 fantastic classic car adventures you can head out on. We've got the solution to classic family motoring and, of course, coverage from Driver Day. So we've been at all sorts of events up and down the country, getting you and your cars into the paper as well. It's our bumper issue, 88 pages. So be sure to pick it up, enjoy it. Lots of fantastic photography adventures and stories in there. Otherwise, I'm, of course, on social media, Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok is at Jesse on Cars. Anyway, we'll be back for the Miami Grand Prix. Have a fantastic time.